We're talking about training, you're talking about readiness, you're talking about in these different types of reports. It is a perfect use case there for Gen AI to plug into these systems and augment the processes that already exist. You don't have to point and click and search a 400-page PDF. You just ask a question in like a human way.
This is The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Matt Sandesberg, Deputy Director of Mad Scientist, and I'll be joined in just a moment by Rachel Melling. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the evolution of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. You can follow us on social media at ArmyMadSci or subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Today we're talking with Ben Van Roo, CEO and co-founder of Yurts, a platform designed for enterprises and government agencies to automate and scale mission-critical tasks. We'll talk with him today about generative artificial intelligence models, how they can be integrated into secure networks, and how TRADOC can use them to enhance Army training. As always, the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or the Training and Doctrine Command. Let's get started.
Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You wrote a blog post for us not too long ago. We kind of got you on here so you can expand on those ideas a little bit. But before we get into that, can you just tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do, and kind of why you're here today?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Ben Van Roo, CEO and co-founder of a company called Yurts. We are a large language model software platform that works with big secure organizations, including the Department of Defense, large secure enterprises that care a lot about their data, care a lot about having control. We're a little bit over 2 years old. We're venture-backed Series B. Our largest customers right now are United States Special Operations Command, United States Army, United States Air Force, Department of Energy. And then we work with other companies in the commercial sector, including semiconductor companies, system integrators, aerospace organizations, et cetera. So a little about me, my background. I grew up in a military family. My father flew F-89s, 102s, and A-10s. My brother's he's just stepped down as a wing commander. So kind of sorry for this audience. Everybody's Air Force in my family. I didn't join, but I went to college, studied computer science engineering, and then eventually went on to get my master's and my PhD in applied mathematics operations research. While I was in school, I started working with the RAND Corporation in the Department of Air Force on large military planning models and the techniques around them. A little bit nerdy, but big optimization models for how we look at different scenarios that, at that time in the mid-2000s and what we were projecting, different future engagements, whether they're humanitarian crises or wars, might look like and how we might support them from strategic and kind of operational supply chains. And so I spent a good number of years in grad school, and then I worked for RAND for a few years after, focusing a lot on that, mainly working with the Department of Defense, Department of Air Force, the Army. And then I did spend some time. Gosh, I traveled all over the world, everything from Japan and Korea to Iraq and Afghanistan, doing projects there. And it was a pretty interesting ride. I went up to the private sector, and in 2012, I've been a startup executive and mainly focusing on artificial intelligence and natural language processing for the good part of the last decade. And then, finally, I think we can kind of go more into it, but launched the company a few years ago after working with the national security community and seeing where I think large language models could apply, but we're having some gaps. And so this has kind of been a long time in the making, but I'm having a lot of fun with the team and glad to be here today.
So Matt mentioned the blog post that you wrote for us, talking about the challenges and opportunities of generative AI. And I'd kind of like to start at the beginning. So could you explain to us what generative AI is and then summarize some of your key points that you made?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. It means a lot to a lot of people at this point. It's not just language. It can be vision-based models that it can be, we're seeing things in video, things in audio, even generative AI in music. And so is it's a newer kind of class of models and techniques that gives us additional abilities not to just potentially understand what's around us. So what's in this image, what's in this article or corpus of articles, where kind of the classical generation of models before what we're now calling large language models or generative AI, where a lot of it was object detection, word detection, find entities, et cetera. And that was really interesting for a while, but it's technically starting around 2017, but you know, kind of what the most of the world knows is kind of launching around the 2022 timeframe with ChatGPT. We started to see an explosion of generative AI technologies where people were using them to write long form documents, generate ideas, heck, critique ideas, create, you know, again, beautiful pictures of something, a lot of, you know, funny jokes or new music. And so this idea of generative is really more about the style of models, the way that we approach the architectures within models and the capabilities that they can unlock. More recently, you're kind of learning of a broader set of models that are kind of that are very buzzy right now around reasoning. One way to describe it is in some ways reasoning is almost like a recursive loop around models where it can kind of go deeper and reassess and go deeper and deeper. And that's maybe a bit of an overgeneralization, but they're still somewhat framed like these traditional generative AI models, but then they add different capabilities on top of it where it's not just saying like, I'm going to spit out a sentence. It's going to say, I'm going to recursively try to understand a series of steps and then take my passes forward on what I want to go and do. And so the state of technology right now is pretty exciting. You know, being in it for about a decade, I can honestly say that right now it feels like about a month to a quarter, every month or quarter is like 1 to 2 years of what it was only 3 or 4 years ago. And even the last, you know, few weeks, if you've followed, you know, what China has done with the launch of a company launched a open source large language reasoning model called DeepSeek. But really, really, the pace is moving extremely fast. And both the technology, the organizational and geopolitical impacts are, it's pretty crazy right now.
So that's great that you brought up DeepSeek, because I want to ask you about our position in sort of the global market for AI and LLMs. We've got ChatGPT, we've got Gemini, there's Copilot, and the DoD, we have CamoGPT, we have NipperGPT, but you also mentioned DeepSeek. So where are we at in this? Are we leading in this research? Are we behind our competitors and adversaries? What's your opinion on that?
That's a great question. There's a few general buckets. There are companies, institutions, AI labs around the world that are focusing on building and training these types of models. There are academics and smaller companies that are working on things like, how do I apply them to my application? There's groups of companies. So my company is much more focused on, and the problem that I'm trying to solve was I saw these models becoming very, very popular, very interesting, very capable back in 2017, 2018. And I was working on a company where we were trying to bring them into parts of the DoD, parts of the intelligence community. And the models were all continuously improving, both the proprietary models and the open source models. And the open source models at the time were like on the order of months behind the proprietary models. What I saw in kind of this third bucket is the implementation of these models and plugging them into the applications that we've already built, across applications that we want to use, the data sources that matter, thinking about access control, how to manage the model. All that stuff is kind of the infrastructure and the plumbing to make these things work in large operational environments, secure environments. And it was at least our perspective when we started the company to focus on that. And so to come to the question specifically, you have people that focus on model training. And in that space, you know, you've got the OpenAIs, Anthropic, you know, XAIs come in. You have a whole crop that are not just in our country. I mean, there's Mistral in France, and these are just like to name kind of a few. Then there's a whole tranche of companies that are focusing on open source. And so that's the Metas of the world. And they play a really big role, I think, in all of this. up to the point where DeepSeek now open sourced their model. You know, there's Microsoft who's obviously does everything on both sides of it, but they have built some of their own models and they've worked with OpenAI to open source some of those. So it's kind of the proprietary model vendors. I think a lot about the open source models vendors, and then those that are focusing on infrastructure. So specifically United States government, you know, we've seen over the last year or so the Nipper GPTs, the Camo GPTs, Scent GPT, there's like one or two on Zipper or above that we can leave those. You know, for our part, we were the deployment infrastructure to basically help roll this out for SOCOM a couple of years back. General Fenton and his team saw this stuff happening, honestly, before ChatGPT. I met them and had some conversations about where we saw the infrastructure and LLMs going. So they had a really interesting foresight. So we're the first to bring open source models to bare metal environments for the Department of Energy, like an enterprise-wide deployment, Nipper for SOCOM. And then we have in the Department of Defense, we have Zipper deployments, and then some stuff moving up into to higher impact level environments. The challenge that, you know, we see is that you can use proprietary models or open source models, but a lot of it is about the environment and the application and the use case. So when you think about, are we behind, the big thing that kind of pushes, like, you know, to what end? It's where's the technology at between an open source training community or company versus a proprietary vendor? So, you know, whether it is Meta versus OpenAI or Anthropic or whatever, you kind of have to see, you know, what's already out in the public domain, and a lot is. The second aspect is, how are we able to use it? So Nipper GPT, Camo GPT, awesome technologies, but for the most part, they are experimental technologies provided by labs, which they would say they're not operational grade software that you're going to rely on when you go into the fight. And so what we need to be thinking about right now is not just about the models, but how do we use them in what we go and do? And so from a technology advancement standpoint, I would probably guess that OpenAI, Anthropic, and a few others are still ahead of the DeepSeeks, the Alibabas, the Mistrals. But like, we're talking about, I believe, on the order of months, not years. Like, I think the misnomer that we have right now is we talk about an AI arms race and people compare it to the Manhattan Project a lot. I think it's like the exact opposite of the Manhattan Project. And I think, you know, people kind of balk at me when I say that, and that this is a technology that's been around for a long time. We've progressed. We've built our academic institutions around it. We've built, you know, the distribution of GPUs is pretty wide. We can think about export controls, but that only goes so far. As soon as models are available, other models or other companies can basically use their models to upgrade and improve their own models. So this is like, it's kind of like all the infrastructure around the learnings. You can't just send this off into Sandia labs and have only a couple people build it. It's everywhere. And so I think when we think about the geopolitical implications and the competition, we really are thinking about a very tight timeline between open source communities, proprietary model vendors, the United States and other countries, whether they're partners or adversaries. And so, I just think the calculus of it is something that we still need to shape, where it's not just a one size fits all. Hey, China's a little bit behind us. Let's just make sure they don't have some GPUs. It's just not going to be that simple.
Yeah. So you talked about how some agencies in the government and even DOD, some of the services in DOD are already using some of these type of capabilities. And so I want to talk a little bit more about your ideas on how you see this type of technology being used in the training space, in the intelligence process. And I know you touched up, this is essentially what your blog talked about, and you talked about specifically within TRADOC, but can you talk a little bit more about that here, with where you see this fitting in and what the benefits to the intelligence process, to the training space would be from using an LLM? And then also within the confines of the government, I know we have to think about the security space as well. So how does something like that work within our rigid security process?
It's fun to talk a little bit about the future and where AI is going and, you know, the geopolitical ramifications. But then there's also kind of like the here and now. And the here and now says, for lots of reasons over the last 20, 30, 40 years, we've built up institutions, security processes, applications, data stores that don't necessarily work to our full advantage. It's hard to find a sit rep that someone wrote a year ago because they've rotated out and now it's in some Outlook or SharePoint site somewhere. And, you know, or even thinking about during the, you know, the wars they were fighting, there'd be dozens of sit reps written each day and like maybe they bubbled their way up, but like how to think about just basic search over that stuff. That's the type of thing where you say, look, like Gen AI today can really help with a lot of the baseline use cases and understanding our operational environment, understanding changes and written ways to, you know, different types of strategy and doctrine, understanding scenarios that we want to model ourselves after. And so I think TRADOC and the missions of training, you know, the warfighter, preparing them for the, whatever environment they're going to, or simulating certain types of environment, baseline aspects of readiness, understanding the equipment guide that's out there, that's like perfect for the state of the technology right now. And so there are interesting kind of little bit nerdy challenges that lie underneath that in how generative AI interacts with those types of data stores. But out of the gate, you know, we're moving into a paradigm where you don't have to point and click and search a 400-page PDF. You just ask a question in like a human way, not a Boolean query that someone's passed down to you for generations, which also, you know, happens in the commercial world. But you just engage with it and you say like, hey, what's going on in this country? How do I have to think about the environment, the geography, the political conditions? Like, just tell me about this. And where Gen AI can help is everything from, all right, let's find you that document if you want to read the document. Let's give you an answer, but cite where it came from. And that's where, you know, I think sometimes we take it for granted when we're thinking about where the future is. It's actually people are just trying to get their heads around like, hey, I've got a million things to do and I'm deploying this location and it's on me to understand that environment. What's happening? Right. Similarly, I think you've got a group of people that also create content. They are reading where the environment is evolving. And so you might have, you know, a CETA somewhere that's an expert on Chinese doctrine. That person is kind of on the other end of a just funnel of information and they're trying to interpret, you know, who is saying what and what this means to all the warfighters that are relying on them to articulate that. Gen AI is also really good at that. Summarize information, even help me understand and give me counterpoints on where this, you know, where this position is versus where they were 9 months ago. You can ask these types of questions to these models and you get really useful answers. The education co-pilot type of model of I want to ask questions and get answers. I want to keep going back and forth, ask more questions. Wide open, super good use case for Gen AI. More advanced use cases of like, I'm in the field, I'm fighting a war. We have different types of sensors. We can talk a little bit about that. But I think as it relates to TRADOC specifically, we're talking about training, you're talking about readiness, you're talking about, you know, these different types of reports along the way. It is a perfect use case there for Gen AI to plug into these systems and augment the processes that already exist. And I think it doesn't supplant, you know, the Odin website, but, you know, you can augment how you do search. You can augment with chat assistants on the side and expect it to get better, you know, and there are errors. You know, you can go to these types of tools and you say, pretend I'm a pirate and then answer that question. And the model's probably going to go and do that, right? Or like, you know, swear like a sailor and answer the questions. It's going to do that. And like, okay, that's funny. And that stuff ends up on Reddit and everyone can have a laugh, but like, you got to go a layer deeper and say, okay, we're in like inning one of how we're going to start to interact with these types of tools. And they're already showing a bunch of value there to the rest of the enterprise of people in the greater intelligence community. Again, you're going to be maybe taking lots of different types of information in different types of forms, different types of content, and you want to ingest and understand and process it. Kind of the same thing goes as before. Gen AI can be really good at sorting it, landing it, summarizing the information, in some cases, even understanding more and more, like how was this different than what someone said last month? The pace at which you can understand, consume, assimilate this information goes through the roof. And so it's a very exciting time for us to all be here.
So it sounds like kind of the lifeblood of a generative AI or an LLM is it has to have a robust corpus of data to look through, and it has to have been trained on that data. So looking at, you know, thinking about the DoD or just the Army even, these are large organizations that have, I don't know what the number would be for the amount of terabytes of data that's been processed. And you even mentioned earlier in one of your answers, you know, sitreps from when people are out in the field, who knows where they are, SharePoint sites, desktops. And even a lot of the data that we produce is intentionally stovepipe because only certain groups should have access to it. So how do you envision getting around those challenges?
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, without making a shameless plug to my own company, I mean, this is why I started this company, is because I had been around the progression of the large language model builders in the, you know, the 16, 17, 18 through 20 timeframe. And for all the right reasons, the companies were focused on, you know, how do we make these stepwise functions to keep making the model better and better and better and better? And, you know, I'd ask executives at some of these companies, because I knew them, how are you thinking about enterprises using this? And like, oh, well, they're going to send us their data. Like, that's not going to happen at all. And so what we did, and how the DoD and any large and secure organization has to immediately think is, okay, we can download a really good model, whether it's proprietary or open source, and we're going to turn it on the enterprise. And it's great, you know, and maybe put a chat interface on it. And even I think of like the amazing work that the government has done with the Nipper GPT or Camel GPT. For the most part, it's just that. It's not tied into the systems, you know, it doesn't have access control. It's not managing the data rights of who can share and what and move and how do you embed this type of content into specific applications. Like that's not necessarily the mission of those labs bringing that out. But once you really want to try to incorporate Gen AI, that's it. So much of this is a privacy and security and thing. And so the DoD, the challenges that it faces is it's not just a SharePoint site doesn't really talk that well to our email site, doesn't talk that well to something else. It's like wholesale applications are on-prem. And you know, you have other types of capabilities that will only run in the cloud. And so you have to think about how are you going to use that data? You might have really state-of-the-art ERP or systems of record like a Palantir or whatever. But how are you going to bridge Gen AI between that and something that's maybe 20 years old, but still really, really useful? And so I think that is the crux of one of the major problems that exists. And it has nothing to do with the models themselves. It's that how do the models work with the systems that actually run the force? You know, again, whether they're procurement or logistics or supply systems, you know, and this is, I'd say, kind of leave your listeners to not be too dismayed that this is just the DoD. Something on the order of 60% of the Fortune 2000 companies, the data that's most important to their company runs on-prem. And so Gen AI actually kind of doesn't matter until it's touching the data that matters for that organization. And so, and this is a real challenge that CIOs have anywhere, is just basically like, you know, my CEO told me to get a 30% improvement or ROI on Gen AI, but it can only touch our Word documents and our email. So structurally, what the DoD has to prepare for is saying like, all right, are we going to allow these systems to be connected to each other? Gen AI is pretty good at helping connect the systems and having the data relate in your ways. But the privacy, the security scenarios, like it is on the one hand, Gen AI can help be the bridge. On the other hand, you know, you have to really trust that you have the right authentication mechanisms, the right backstops in place. And this is even before we're in a world where we're actually having Gen AI get closer with agents on making autonomous decisions or taking steps on their own. I think we'll continue to see these really cool improvements in the models, and that still carries a lot of the media attention. But the reality is it's not going to really move the needle until the systems, the TTPs, everything that we do today is actually kind of plugged in and integrated. And so I think it's a big challenge and an opportunity for the DoD.
Yeah. And so thinking larger, what should the Army and the DoD be doing now or as a next step to successfully integrate generative AI into our processes?
It's a good question. What it's doing now is you do see a lot more experimentation come into play. Everything from CBRS to OTs to DIU is putting together different types of approaches. And they're asking a range of questions. There are things in computer vision. There are, you know, we're trying to see, hey, can we do course of action? Can we use large language models for COAs? All that experimentation is great. And I think that that's realistically going to continue for a couple of reasons. One, because this is a pretty big organization, the Department of Defense, the United States Army. And as fun as all these technologies are, there's real implications of getting things wrong. And Gen AI is far from right all the time. It's great a lot of things, and it's continuing to improve, but it's not perfectly right. But we're not really going to get beyond that until we first start to understand the use cases, continue to evolve the use cases, think about the architectures on how we'd want to consume this type of information and where we want to apply it. And then frankly, there's just only RDT&E budgets going after Gen AI for the most part, and they're not awarding $1 billion Gen AI contracts, right? Which I would also say don't. There's not that many things that are worth $1 billion in Gen AI just yet. But I think the experimentation is actually really exciting, and I think a lot of people have leaned in, especially over this past year. The one thing that I would also kind of caution, and we do see it in other technologies, but we're in a world where there are actually a number of really good commercial vendors, and everyone wants to play, including the government themselves. And it's going to have to decide, what is the role of the government? Are we writing software? Which I think in the experimentation phase is great. In perpetuity, doesn't make sense, because three soldiers or four airmen can't completely displace a 500 person or 1,000 person or 2,000 person venture-backed company that's building this for lots of people. What it can do is better understand the last mile of the applications. What it can do is bridge the gap between the technology vendors and the warfighter. And I think that's like the key point. So, first things first, continue to experiment, understand use cases, think much more about how you want to deploy, figure out ways to find the capital to go after it, and then finally kind of understand and position the government's role accordingly.
So you mentioned earlier that the timelines are getting more and more compressed. What used to take a year or two in technology increases is now about a month or two. So this is kind of a big question then based on that. How do you see this technology evolving over the next 10 years, both in terms of support for the government, but also in things like governance and policy within the government?
Yeah, I mean, I think the next 2 to 3 years, what the real focus is going to be is about, in general, for the organizations, the DoD, large corporations, 25, 26, 27 is going to be about bringing Gen AI into production. And so we're moving beyond an experimental chat bot that someone stood up in their unit to do X on 5 documents, which is like super, super exciting and fun. And it kind of works to like, okay, how is this plugged into everything we do and not do? And where do we not want it? How do we think about managing it as part of our enterprise? So, the management of costs and models and analytics of who's doing what, asking what, all of that stuff is still just infrastructure that is going to be part of the IT administrators, the corporate governance, or the DoD of, how are these technologies being used? How is this moving us all forward? Now, in the kind of the more cutting edge circles of people that are building the models, it's going to continue to be an arms race to kind of almost think of like a multipolar, multi-organization Cold War, where a lot of Gen AI technologies will just be ubiquitous. And I think like the geopolitical, the social ramifications of that are still really unknown in the, let's say, 7 to 10 year timeframe. And I think it's going to be pretty impactful. White collar workers, a lot of tasks will continue to go away. And even, executive level tasks will potentially go away. I think it's a really good opportunity right now for everyone that's listening, that if they are not using these types of technologies, to just get really good at it. Do it in the appropriate channels. Don't send stuff over to ChatGPT and, or whatever. But I think take the right steps. And, today you see about 5 different companies that have either open sourced or offered their model, these kind of more advanced reasoning models, as part of their existing products or at a really low cost. Like that's like a 2-week timeframe where it's like, hey, the most cutting edge technology went from, hey, this is why we're exquisite, to basically everybody's got it. And so 7 years from now, I think it is very unclear where it all goes. But at this pace, it will have pretty profound impact on what we do. And like, I don't think I'm a big huckster and overselling the hype. I think I've been around this a long time to say, yeah, everyone that I talk to, which is a lot of people, are as much talking about what does it mean and organizations that are AI, that are truly AI centric, where every meeting's recorded, all the documents stored, communication moves up, down, and horizontally and vertically. I mean, for example, my company has everything wired to our own internal version of our software. So integrate Confluence, Jira, Word, Salesforce, our linear tickets. And so, you know, frankly, like everything from like, when is the next holiday to what did we do in this product cycle last month? It spans everything. And when you start thinking about that level of intelligence, organization, and basically distribution, on the one hand, you know, it's a very different workplace. In the operational setting, your OODA loop, you know, so to speak, could also take that type of effect where it just moves extremely fast. So kind of coming back to things like military planning, you know, you're talking about very, very, very much shortening the cycles between when you observe something to when you want to take action. And then so, you know, it's everything, just the intelligence information space to the kill chain itself could move shorter and shorter and shorter.
That's a lot of good stuff there. Great points. I think the most honest part of that was when looking out 7 to 10 years at a technology like that, it's unclear. And I think that's true. I think we have some idea of what could happen and where how this could evolve. But 7 to 10 years is a very long time for something that's adapting so quickly here. Those were the big questions we had for you, Ben. But I want to roll into our rapid fire questions, which we're kind of springing on you here. You weren't prepared for these. So we ask three questions. They're always the same to our guests. It tells us a little bit about you as a person. So we'll throw one at you. Just give us a quick response to it. The first one is, what's a tech or a trend that kind of keeps you up at night, something you're kind of fearful about?
I think the state of robotics and UAVs as it relates to, you know, also the interfusion with AI is extremely exciting. And also the 7 to 10 year time frame is like makes me think a little bit uncertain about how fast it's moving. So that is one that I'm cautiously optimistic, but again, could have real different ramifications on how we think about the world, geopolitics, stability, everything.
Second question is, what's something about you that most people might not know that you're willing to share here?
Let's see. You know, earlier in life, I had lots of fun hobbies of sports, triathlons, a lot of hiking. I was in the outdoors a lot. Now I have a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old company. So I think most of my time and energy is dedicated to trying to keep those three and my family afloat. But yeah, I mean, I think I'm very passionate about the space. I enjoy being associated with the mission. I fully recognize that I did not serve in the armed forces, but ironically have been around it basically my entire life. So I find a lot of fun and passion in just doing what I'm doing, because it's kind of the intersection of everything professionally and mission-wise that I like to support. So the other cool things about that I like to do is if I can go on a long run, and I live up in the mountains in Northern California. And if I can get out on a long run, usually get to clear my mind and think about, again, where are these things going in 7 to 10 years? And so that's what I like to do.
Oh, that's awesome. I like that answer. Here's the final one. Maybe it'll be a little bit easier for you. What's your favorite movie?
Oh, God, that's like an incredibly hard answer.
I know. I was just kidding. Question.
All right. But. So I think I got it. I think I got the answers right now. Around Christmas is like my only splurge time when I'm like, I really need to watch movies. So currently I'm in a cycle where on the holidays, for whatever reason, I like watching the two financial crash movies, The Big Short and Boiler Room. And my father and I have watched Band of Brothers for an extremely long time. And I still think every year around Christmas, if not twice a year, I still watch the series. So it's not a movie technically, but it's something that I always find super humbling and interesting. And, you know, I like the history of it. And obviously it's a super impactful moment in time.
Yeah, no, we will allow Band of Brothers, not only because of how high in regard it's held, but also I think we did have a guest before who mentioned it. So we allowed it back then. We have to allow it now. So So good. You're in the clear there, Ben.
Oh, I will say excitingly, my five-year-old and I, we finally watched, he got to watch episode 4 because he was sick this last weekend. And so we watched Star Wars episode 4, you know, and that's always kind of a cool moment when you, if you're kind of a Star Wars nerd, to be able to sit down and have the first, you know, time that your kids will watch it with you. And it you know, he wasn't too scared of Darth Vader. So it all went well.
Excellent. That's a big moment in his life. So Ben, that's going to wrap it up for our conversation today. We want to thank you for coming on and talking to us about generative AI and for writing that blog post. So anybody listening, if you're hearing this podcast, please go back and check out Ben's blog post on the Mad Scientist Laboratory. Ben, do you have any parting words before we go?
No, I appreciate everyone that listens and is associated with the U.S. Army, the DOD, and obviously within TRADOC. If you want to read random policy defense AI blogs, I usually write some articles every few weeks, so you can check me out on Substack.
Awesome. Yeah, that's right up our listeners' alley, so you're right on point there. Well, Ben, once again, thanks for coming on the show.
All right. Thank you, guys. Appreciate being here.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guest, Ben Van Roo. You can follow us on social media at @ArmyMadSci, and don't forget to subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you accessed it. This feedback helps us improve future episodes of The Convergence and allows us to reach a bigger and broader audience.